From Reclaim the Media in Seattle and the Northwest Community Radio Network, it's Listen Up Northwest. Each week we bring you a roundup of stories from communities throughout our region. I'm your host, Yuko Kadama. On today's show, we take a look at issues around motherhood and birthing. Many people have the impression that midwives are Mother Earth hippies, but attitudes are changing as more people are choosing home birth over having their baby at the hospital. Find out why. A tribal elder relates her firsthand account of being sterilized under Canadian law against her will. And there comes a time when you realize that your mother is not just your mom, she's her own person too. From Moscow, Idaho, some reflections on this fateful moment. Stay tuned for these stories and more on this week's edition of Listen Up Northwest. Having a baby at home is common throughout the world, except in the U.S., where most deliveries take place in the hospital. But a growing number of Americans are choosing to have their babies at home with the help of friends, family, and a midwife. Julie Sabatier of Destination DIY brings us two interviews, one with a Portland midwife who's witnessed hundreds of births, and one with a mom who talks about why she chose to have her second baby at home.
Birth and baby making is a do-it-yourself project as old as human history. Women all over the world give birth every day in their own homes, with the assistance of their families and midwives. Here in the so-called developed world, many women choose to give birth in a hospital with the help of pharmaceuticals. Home birth has become an alternative to that norm. Still, a whole host of midwifery practices are thriving in Portland and other places. I spoke with Susan Murray, a certified professional midwife. Susan is also the press liaison for the Midwives Alliance for North America, and she's been practicing in Portland since 1996. She and her professional partner exclusively attend home births.
So are all home births natural births in that they don't have epidural or pain medication?
Yes. Yeah, the things that we use to assist a woman with her pain are encouragement, touch. Everybody in this town does water birth, and that's a big helper for pain. Allowing a woman to move around, allowing her to eat and drink. Those are all things that I think most women find helps them make their pain tolerable.
Yeah, and so what are some of the advantages as you see them to home birth?
I believe that the biggest advantage to home birth is the awareness that a woman is bigger than the pain of labor. Some women who believe that their body couldn't do it lose confidence in themselves, and I think you need a lot of confidence to be a parent. It's a huge, long-lasting job, and you need to know how strong you are.
Well, so how does home birth teach you that in a way that maybe a hospital birth couldn't?
It's the woman doing it herself, really, and we're just there to, you know, kind of guard it a little bit. And if there's any necessary moments when we need to step in and help, we do. And because we have so many women give birth in a tub, we encourage them to catch their own baby. So we don't even put our hands in there. I mean, we have long gloves and we can put our hands in the water, but because she's sort of just in this little bubble, she pushes her baby out, she catches her own baby, she brings her baby up to her chest. And so we're thrilled if we facilitated something like that.
Well, and I mean, I understand that there are some conditions that maybe exclude women from being able to give birth at home. Can you tell me about that?
Well, fortunately in Oregon, they are not breeches and twins. We are allowed to do those under optimal circumstances. But the things that prevent us from doing a home birth are excessively high blood pressure, gestational diabetes, women that need certain medications, you know, babies with certain anomalies and conditions that really need the benefit of being born in a hospital for immediate care.
And what kinds of things can interrupt a home birth and make you have to go to the hospital?
Well, most of the transports that we do from a home birth are not emergencies. Usually it's with a woman having her first baby, and it's a longer labor where she's probably not had a lot of sleep and her threshold for pain is going down. And so she wants some medical support for pain and maybe to augment her labor, to speed up her labor. And I think only about, in our practice, only about 7 to 8% of first-time mothers have that experience.
Well, what kinds of things are surprising to people about home birth that maybe they don't usually expect that you try to either try to prepare them for, or you just sort of find that no matter what you do, they're surprised?
You know, I think the biggest surprises that I hear about are in male partners who think that midwives aren't professional, that they're all, you know, Mother Earth hippies. They're afraid. They love their partner. They're afraid that emergency equipment won't be available. And then they find out, you know, that it is, and that they're dealing with people who know what they're doing. And they have the added benefit of after the birth of having an experience that was not extremely scary.
My cousin Emily and her family live just outside San Diego, California. Earlier this summer, we both found ourselves in Florida for our grandparents' 60th wedding anniversary.
Do you want to just introduce yourself?
Okay. Yeah, I'm Emily Toe.
Emily told me how she decided to have her second child at home after giving birth to her daughter Talia in the hospital. And she was kind enough to step into a quiet room with me so I could record what she had to say.
So how did you decide to give birth to Elijah at home?
Well, Elijah is my second child, and with my first child, the birth was, you know, simple and straightforward, and we were really into doing it naturally, and we took Bradley Method classes. That birth after she was born, I thought, boy, I could have done that at home, and then we wouldn't have had the most stressful part of the birth, which was the drive to the hospital in morning rush hour traffic when I was almost ready to start pushing. So when Elijah came about, I decided that we were going to do something else. So that's when I started seriously looking into home birth.
And you decided to have a water birth as well.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
With Elijah, we had a really big bathtub, and the idea of giving birth in the water was appealing to me. And so it was a good thing, actually, that I did, because I had a giant baby. He weighed 10 pounds, 2 ounces. We didn't know he was going to be that big. He was only 3 days past his due date. It was a big surprise. But the water eases the pressure as you're pushing the baby out. And my first daughter was 7 pounds, 15 ounces. And she was not born in the water. And it was actually more difficult with her, the pushing. And so, it was just very gentle. And he came out smoothly. And we didn't have any complications, no tears or anything, which for a baby that size is pretty remarkable.
And what was Jody, your husband's, role in the home birth?
He was my partner in every sense of the word. He was thinking one step ahead of me because he knew that every single ounce of my concentration had to be focused on giving birth to the baby. So he called the midwives and he called my mom, and he made sure that the front door was unlocked so that when people got there, they wouldn't have to ring the doorbell, so he wouldn't have to leave my side. And he actually caught the baby, as he did with our first daughter. They were his hands that touched both of our kids first when they were born. And Elijah was a slippery little guy in the bath water too. That was trickier, but he caught him, took him right out, and gave him to me. It's just more intuitive, and it's a neat sort of extension of your relationship to be working together in a way like that. And it was really, just really bonded us as a family, I think.
Well, so you gave birth to Talia, your first child, in the hospital, and then Elijah at home. And what would you say were the biggest differences between the two?
The act of leaving your home when you're in labor is really scary. It was for me anyway. It was terrifying to be walking down the stairs in the middle of contractions and going out into the cold morning and having to ease my way into a car and worry about traffic and then be in an unfamiliar place where the first thing I had to do was go and take off my clothes and put on a gown and get in this bed, and there were strange smells and lights that were too bright and people who I didn't know coming in and out while the birth was going on. And of course, at home, you have your own space. You can move around. You know where everything is. It's your own bed and your own sheets and your own bathtub. And afterwards, you can take a shower in your own shower and then lie down in your bed while somebody brings you a meal that they've cooked in your kitchen. Talia was almost 4 at the time, and she was able to be there and present for the whole thing.
And what about the issue of healthcare? I mean, did your healthcare plan pay for the midwife and the home birth?
No, they did not. And we had to pay out of pocket. We struggled because it wasn't cheap and we didn't have lots of money put away for anything like that. But we decided that it was worth it to us to be able to do it ourselves and to have the kind of birth that we wanted. He's almost definitely going to be our last child, and I didn't want to have any regrets surrounding his birth. So it was money well spent.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you.
That was Julie Sabatier of Portland, Oregon's Destination DIY interviewing Emily Toe. Before that was her interview with midwife Susan Murray. For more information about midwifery, you can visit mana.org. We go from a story about one's choices in where to have a birth to a story about having your right to birthing taken away. British Columbia passed a Sexual Sterilization Act in 1933. The act was designed to decrease the number of Native or First Nations people in Canada. Procedures are said to have taken place up through the 1980s. Major West Coast sterilization centers were built in Bella Bella and Nanaimo, British Columbia. Kevin Annette of CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio contributed this interview with Sarah Modeste, a First Nations elder in Canada who tells the story of being sterilized against her will.
Okay, my name is Tishat. My given name is Sarah. My married name is Modeste. My experience with Dr. Goodbrand started from my marriage. Before our wedding day, we were asked to go and see a doctor. And there's only one doctor. We weren't allowed to see anybody else. With my first visit, he started to tell me that I shouldn't have children with Fred. And I asked him why. He said he's in a chief line, and he said that isn't good. So I said, it isn't good for who? And he said, never mind. He says, it just isn't good. And I told him, I says, well, I'm not listening to this. I'm having children anyway. He asked for me to come back. He said, I'll arrange it so that you won't have any children. And I told him, I says, I'm not coming back for that kind of a thing. Fred and I got married. I got pregnant. And I waited till I was 6 months along, and then I went to see Dr. Goodbrand. And when I saw him, when he saw that I was pregnant, he was so angry that he just about hit me. He said, how dare you? You know, he mumbled some swear words at me. So my daughter was born. She was healthy. And there was nothing wrong with the delivery. And he wasn't there when she was born. A nurse, a red-headed nurse, came and helped me give birth. And then 2 hours after, he got there, and then they wheeled me into the back room, and I don't know what they did, but I know they have to clean something. But then when I came back out, I just didn't feel right. I couldn't feed my child after. My milk dried up. And I asked him, why is that happening? Because the birth was normal. And he said, oh, there's something wrong. I became pregnant again. And I had a miscarriage. And then I start talking to him about it, and he boasted that he did something to stop me from having children. And he says, not to tell anybody. He says, it's your word against mine. He was given an amount of money to make sure that I didn't have a family. And he said that if I had married a white man, I probably could have a family, but marrying a Native person, that I shouldn't have a family. He said this Native Indian Affairs had the funding, and he had to try and get as many women as he could from the area. There were a lot of times that he told me that we as First Nations are scum of the earth, and he said we had to be gotten rid of. That's the expression he used when he was really angry with me, because I argued with him. I argued with him about my right as a woman, my right to have children. I told him, if I don't want children, I'll come to you and I'll ask you to help me. When my daughter was, 5 years old, I started to drink because I couldn't have children. I worked really hard towards helping other ladies who go through the same thing. And I thought I was the only one that happened to. I talked to several others and they said this Dr. Goodbrand did the same thing to them. He married someone from a chief line. Some of the ladies were just healthy ladies. They weren't allowed to have children. I had one good friend I went to school with, and she told me he did the same thing with her, and she ended up with surgery. Her husband wanted a family, and she couldn't have children. She became an alcoholic. I can't feel anger, and I can't feel resentment, because it isn't part of our culture. I don't accept it, because it isn't right. The history that is written is wrong. There is no history books in Canada or in BC or USA that has the proper language written in it. I feel that it's really unjust what has happened to me personally. The only thing I'm thankful for is that I'm still alive to be able to give teaching to our children. And right now I have to teach them verbally. The government has a lot to answer for. They have caused too much pain with our people. And it still goes on today. It's 5 generations back to my grandfather and to the great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren that he has. And they suffer with that. But they don't know why. Where do they get this pain from? They get it from the residential school and the treatment by the Government of Canada.
That was an interview with First Nations Elder Sarah Modeste in British Columbia, contributed by Kevin Annette of CFRO Radio. For more information about Canadian sterilization of First Nations people, you can visit hiddenfromhistory.org. When is the right time to have a child? In the next piece about motherhood and birthing, Jean talks about how she needed to make a critical decision of whether or not to go through with a pregnancy. This piece was contributed by Julia Dong with the help of Sasha Summer Cousineau of KBCS in Bellevue, Washington.
You know, it's kind of hard to talk about your life in the context of a few months around which you made a big set of decisions. Indeed, everything that came before was part of that decision or affected how that unfolded. And everything that has come since is affected by the decision itself. In my particular case, I was an oldest child. I was a little bit rigid, probably ADD, but they didn't have that for girls back then. A fair amount of anxiety, a little bit high-strung. I made a choice of college that wasn't a particularly well-suited choice. And college at that time was pretty much open season. It was pretty sexually open, and when I turned 18, well, before I turned 18, I was drinking. Looking back on it, in a way, I was behaving like a 12 or 13-year-old. Not very good judgment, but they try on personalities. And I was doing that kind of thing. But I was doing it, and it involved bars, and it involved dating different guys, and eventually I ended up getting pregnant. I wasn't anywhere near ready to be anybody's mother. I didn't have a way to earn a living. I didn't manage my daily life in a way that I was proud of or wanted to be in. I wanted to be out of that life, but here I was, and I certainly didn't want to bring somebody else into it. And I couldn't take appropriate responsibility for somebody. I knew that I wasn't healthy. I knew that I'd already been drinking while this fetus, you know, while the embryo was starting out. And the likelihood of damage was quite high. Never mind the kind of damage I could do over the course of the formative years of a child who had a desperately angry mother who was drinking excessively. And I went to a local facility where they handle those sorts of things, and I arranged for an abortion. I went through the intake interview. I was really quite clear. It was a really clean decision. I didn't have what it took to be somebody's mother. And I certainly didn't want to take it lightly. I wasn't taking it lightly. I understood the different stages of development. There's no question that a life exists. However, it's not a life that exists independently. And for me, philosophically, the underlying value was more important to me that I get grounded and whole and not bring somebody else into such a damaged environment. In a way, it helped me more clearly see my obligation to become a better person. I truly believe we kind of go around and around. So if you have that sense, then it's okay. I mean, you get to try again. There is a sort of built-in forgiveness to that notion. When I became pregnant with my first child who was born, I remember thinking about that baby and how old that baby would have been. And that was, it was sad, but I was also so grateful that I had not brought that child into what I could offer at that time. I matured enough to realize that alcohol and I didn't need to have an ongoing relationship. My husband and I had been married for 3 or 4 years, had achieved a lot of balance and some sobriety and some continuity. I'd gotten my feet under me. I'd finished a degree. I was functioning in the world, and I was emotionally maturing enough to understand the scope of responsibility that having a child takes. When we got pregnant the first time, I felt a great wash of awareness. It took me a while to figure it out that that's what it was, because I hadn't carried a pregnancy past a couple months before, but it was a glowing awareness of, oh, now I have the gift. Now I am enough. And this person will manifest everything I couldn't give to the other one. The two daughters I have raised are extraordinarily good, high-quality people of integrity. They're not children whose mother raged at them. They're not children whose mother left them for long periods of time. They're not children whose mother lay passed out on the couch. They're children whose mother was present and aware and connected. And that's a very valuable gift.
You just listened to a piece contributed by Julia Donk and Sasha Summer Cousineau. Everyone's been there. The day you realize that your mom is a regular person with her own plans, dreams, and values. When was it for you? Sandy Billings of KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, brings us the recollections of some people in her town.
When did you realize your mom was a person? The answers we got were very interesting. Here's a few of them.
I think it was when she set the car on fire. We were driving. And I think I must have been about 6 or 7, and she pulled over. And she said, "Well, kids, I think we better get out." And we walked out of the car and went to the person's house. It was just down the road from where we lived. And I looked back, and there was flames coming from the hood of the car. I still don't know what happened, but then I realized my mom couldn't do everything because she set a car on fire.
Okay, this isn't when I realized that my mom was a person, because I know she's a person, but the coolest time that I spent appreciating and, I guess, learning the most about my mom was when I went to her retirement party and heard all the great stories and saw all the cool people at her job that cared about her so much. I'm gonna cry. And it was so touching, and it was so amazing to see her in that way.
The first time I became aware of my mom being a person, I'm sure there's a different time, but what comes to my mind is that my mother is a white Wiccan or a pagan, and my dad was raised Catholic, but we grew up in Aurora, which is just right outside of Denver, Colorado, and the neighborhood was pretty bad, so the public school had, you know, metal detectors, and there was a shooting the day that we went to check out the school. So my mom sent me to the Catholic school, and I wasn't Catholic, but I wanted to become Catholic because all of my friends were Catholic. And so I was baptized when I was in sixth grade and went through all of the ceremonies. But when you first said, when did you realize your mom was a person, was I thought my mom was weird for the practices that she had. You know, on full moon, she would put these blue rocks in her shoes and go outside and, you know, say like a ritual to all of the directions, north, south, east, and west. And I came back from school, and I had walked all the way home after Ash Wednesday, and I went to Mass. And when you go to Mass and you're Catholic on Ash Wednesday, the priest dips his thumb into ashes, and he puts a cross on your forehead. And then I walked home with all of my friends, and my mom came home at like 5 o'clock or something, and she said, "There is a black cross on your forehead. What in the hell are they teaching you at that school?" You know? And it just, at that one moment, I realized, wow, this is kind of strange. What I'm doing is kind of strange. What I'm part of is just as strange to my mom as what I think is strange to her. And I realized that, oh, she's a person and she has her beliefs too. And, you know, she may disagree with me. And so when you said that, that's the first thing that came to my mind, was when she was shocked at the black cross on my forehead.
When did you first realize that your mother is a person?
When probably she told me at 5, go the f- ahead and run away. I don't care. Here's your bag. That was a strong argument for a person to make.
And she wasn't a godlike creature anymore after that.
Nope. She
was definitely a- you know, I can't use that on the radio.
A hateful person.
Listen Up Northwest is produced by Reclaim the Media at the studios of KBCS for the Northwest Community Radio Network. Find out more at nwcommunityradio.org. Thanks to contributors Kevin Annette, Sandy Billings, Julia Donk, Julie Sabatier, and Sasha Summer Cousineau. Music by local artists DJ B-Girl, The Butter Sprites, and Ali Ippolito. Special thanks to our copy editor, Robin Block, and thank you for listening to and supporting your community radio station. For Listen Up Northwest, this is Yuko Kadama.